Welcome back to the Grief Observe podcast. I'm your host, Brad Morrell. And if you want to be on the podcast to tell your story of grief, please contact me at griefobservepodcast@gmail.com. I will have that email in the show description. My guest today is Gary Sturgis. He has lots of contacts out there in the grief world, and he's written several books. He works with bereavement support groups and is also a grief coach. So, Gary, welcome to the show. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Brad. Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. So I've looked a little bit over your Facebook page and all that. I'll have in the show description as well as far as links to your books on Amazon. And so tell me where your heart for grief began and how did you get into this?
Well, I lost my spouse in 2014 to stage 4 metastatic melanoma. And I always say that that's just a fancy medical term for really bad cancer. Mm-hmm. And so after my loss, I was finding it difficult to find resources for grief and loss. And I felt very alone after that loss. And it was important to me to have to do something to help other people not feel the way I felt. So I decided at that point to, you know, seek help myself. And so I did that by going into a grief support group myself. And I found that very helpful after my loss. And in doing that, I did two groups after my loss. And the social worker that was running the group at the time asked me if I was interested in, you know, after some time had gone by, being a co-facilitator in the group with her. And so she became somewhat of a mentor to me. And I went through training to become a facilitator, and I started facilitating grief support groups. And after that happened, she said, you know, maybe you should write your story. So I wrote my first book that's called Surviving, Finding Your Way from Grief to Healing. And in that book, I talk about my journey through my loss, my journey through how I processed my grief, and then the healing and the aftermath of my loss. And so it just kind of snowballed from there. You know, I created a Facebook page called Surviving Grief, as well as a website called Surviving Grief. And then I wrote two additional books on grief and loss. And after that, I started doing grief coaching. I trained to be a grief coach. And so now I do grief coaching online for people. You know, groups are a great thing, but they're not always for everyone. Some people are, you know, comfortable in a group sharing their personal story, but some people aren't. So grief coaching gives them the ability to have a safe space to do that. And they can do it in the privacy of their home, which is great. And, you know, I think it's beneficial to people. Some people have, you know, the ability to do both, which I did. I went to a grief support group, but I also saw a grief counselor after my loss. So sometimes it's beneficial even to do both. So it just kind of snowballed, and that's where I am now.
Yeah. So did it take you a long time to write that first book, or was it something that was just really quick? And I don't know. So, how did that develop?
Yeah. So how that came about was when she had asked me to write the book, I didn't feel like I was ready to write the book. And the reason being that in the beginning, you know, I was so deep in my grief, and I thought, you know, if I write this book, it's going to be sad, you know, and people reading it who are grieving maybe want to hear something hopeful as opposed to just reading another person's sad story. And so I decided to wait. And so I didn't write the book until about 4 years after my loss, after I had gone through the process of, you know, grieving and doing my grief work and finding a place of peace and hope. And so it was more important to me to write the book then. So at that point in time, I felt like it was the right time to write the book. And that's when I wrote it. So I feel like my book, you know, is more about the stages that I went through in the process, but it also ends on a hopeful note, because I truly believe that after you have a significant loss, whether it's a spouse or a partner or a child, sibling, you know, whatever that loss may be, and it doesn't necessarily even have to be a person. You know, you can have a divorce, or you can lose a job, or lose your home, or any of those kind of things cause grief. And so I wanted to make sure that my book gave people hope as well as learning more about grief.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that we all start searching for immediately, or maybe not even immediately. After that shock period, perhaps, but looking for hope in small places and learning to, I think, make meaning again out of life. Before we came on, I spoke. Sometimes I feel like it takes something really hard for us to start searching what is the meaning of my own life. So I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts on your own mortality at this point?
I think before my loss, I think before we lose someone that we love and before we suffer grief, we don't really think about it. It's like we kind of think, we're gonna marry this person or be with this person and we're both gonna die on the same day at the same time, and it's one of those things we really don't give much thought to. And then after my loss, I thought, oh, that I think we always believe that it's going to happen to somebody else. We watch these catastrophic things on the news and we have, compassion and empathy for it, but then we shut the TV off and go and cook dinner and we get back to our lives. But I think after you have a loss, it's a little different because you get this new eye-opening concept of this can happen to me too. This can happen to anybody. And so I think for myself, I guess maybe before my loss, I feared death and now I don't. I guess I just know now that, just as birth is part of a life, so is death. So, that's what's going to happen to everyone. There's 100% chance that every single one of us is going to die someday. So I think I don't really fear mortality that much. I think of my mortality, but I try now. I think a gift that comes from losing someone you love is the gift of knowing that each day is important and you have to make the best of each day because you never know if that day is going to be the last one.
Yeah, I tell my clients often that, the worst truth that I can give someone is the fact that we will say goodbye to everyone that we know here in some form or fashion, whether it is through a divorce, whether it is through a death, whether it is a friend passing through a moment in time. I sit here and think of how many friends that I've had in this lifetime and think, wow, there's so many of them that I don't have contact with anymore. So the fact is, when there's a two-party relationship, one of you will be saying goodbye probably before the other. And that's a hard truth.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell me more about the book. I know you've got one that's 365 days, and I think that's super important to have something for people to go to every day of the year. Tell me more about that book.
Yeah, so that book sells really well for the reason that, when you're grieving, the last thing you can do is focus on anything. And I personally w love to read. And when I had my loss, I couldn't read at all. I couldn't even pick up a book. And for me, that was another loss. It was almost like a secondary loss because I thought, okay, I lost this person I love, and now I lost this thing that brought me joy. I can't read. And it's because, your mind is in such a fog after a significant loss. And so I wanted to write a book where a person could just read something, a page or two a day and get something from some aspect of grief and loss and maybe something hopeful from that, whatever they're reading, and give them a chance to not have to, nobody wants to read War and Peace when they, a book like War and Peace when they're grieving. So
Right.
I find that people find it easier to just read a page or two a day and get something from that and then go on with their day. So I wrote it really for that reason, knowing the audience of grieving people were not going to want to read a big book. So it is, in fact, a big book because it's clearly more than 365 pages, but you really only have to read one or 1.5 pages a day in that book.
Nice. You spoke of secondary losses, and I have spoken of that here on the podcast before, but in case someone's tuning in for the first time, why don't you explain secondary losses and maybe some of those losses that you've experienced in your own life?
Yeah, so like I said, reading was one of them for me. And then a lot of secondary losses come from, it depends on the nature of the loss, the relationship, the unique relationship you have with the person that dies. So for example, if you're a mother who lost, or you're a mom who lost a child, And you were a soccer mom, your child played soccer, and so your life was centered around, bringing this child to soccer and hanging out with all the other soccer moms. And then when you lose that child, you don't go to those soccer games anymore. And so that's a secondary loss. You're losing that aspect of your life that you had before. It was somewhat your purpose too. And you hear a lot of people that are grieving talk about losing their purpose. What's the meaning of my life now that this person has died? And so a secondary loss can be as simple as me losing my desire to read, and it can also be the social aspect of your loss, because now if you were a couple and you were going out with other couples, you're now third wheel, and so that feels like a loss. And a lot of people, after a loss, if you're a couple and you're paying the mortgage and you're on two salaries and one of you dies, the other one can't afford to pay the mortgage, so maybe you lose your house. So that's a secondary loss. There's just so many secondary losses. And then sometimes after someone dies, you may lose another person, and so that's a secondary loss. And so all these losses just add up to, add on to that grief that you're already experiencing from that one primary loss.
Yeah, you spoke about losing other people, and I think sometimes through loss, sometimes relationships change. The people that were, I'll say, attached to the individual that we lost, sometimes those relationships change or deteriorate or simply fade away completely. Have you experienced any of that in your own life?
I did. And I tell the people in my support groups, because that's a big one for them. They always say there were people in my life that I thought would be there and they weren't. And it's an interesting thing, because I think when people in our lives, and even people that love us, they can be friends, they can be family, is they know how to deal with you, but they don't know how to deal with a grieving you. So, because your loss changes you as a person, and it's a big change, that they now can't really relate to this person that they could relate to before your loss. And so I always equate it to like being in a boat on a calm water, and there's all these people in your boat. And then when you have your loss, the boat rocks, and some people fall out, and some people stay in. And the people that stay in are the people that can deal with your loss, and they can deal with the grieving you. And then there's people that fall out. And sometimes those people that fall out are the people you least expect to fall out. But one of the gifts, and I always say that there's gifts that come from grief, and people think that sounds strange that you would get a gift from grief. But one of the gifts from grief is that some people get in your boat and they stay in your boat, and they're people that you never imagined. Sometimes they can be total strangers, and these people become, what I call your tribe. And so for me, I have people in my life right now that I did not have in my life before my loss, and those people are in my life because of my loss. And when I think about those people, I think, I'm so honored to have these people in my life. They wouldn't be in my life if it wasn't for my loss. So that to me is a gift that came from my loss and my grief, is that I can't imagine my life without these people, yet they came into it because something really horrible happened.
I like the analogy there of the boat. And, I'm sitting here just thinking as you're speaking that, especially if we feel like our boat is sinking, it's really easy to see why people would jump off the boat. But how many people are going to climb on to a sinking boat? That's an amazing picture. And I think, wow, those have to be some really good friends that, jump on the boat when you're at the lowest.
And I think, the greatest gift that you can give someone, for people that are wondering, I get people that ask me all the time, being a grief specialist, my sister died. How can I support her? What can I do? What can I say? And I always say, there's nothing specific that you can say, but just be present. Be there for that person and let them know that you can kneel down and be in that place of pain with them, and that you're not afraid of that. And like you said, those are the people that get into the boat, that have the courage to get into the boat and love you and care about you enough to to sit with you in that place of grief. And sometimes you don't have to say anything at all. You just need to let them know that you're able and willing to do that.
You know, keeping with the boat analogy, I see most of your books have what seems to be a nautical theme. Do you like the water?
Yeah, so I do. I very much like the water. And so after my loss, I live near the beach. And so I live on the coast. And so I would walk the beach and I would cry. That was my therapy, you know, and I tell people all the time, like, getting out in nature is a good way to soothe some of the pain of your grief. And so I would walk the beach. And so in my mind, I would picture grieving as drowning in the ocean, and you're drowning and you don't know how you're going to stay afloat. And so you need someone to throw you a life ring, you know, something to hold on to. And so that analogy would always come to my mind. So when I wrote my first book, I thought, well, what do I want to put on the cover of this book? And I thought, I want it to be the ocean, and I want there to be a life ring floating on it. And so you may notice if I call my Surviving Grief 365 Days a Year book a companion to my first book, Surviving, and the life ring is now on shore. You know, so I wanted to kind of give people that analogy of, like, here's this life floating out in this ocean, and that's how you feel. You know, you're looking for that life ring, you're looking for something to hold on to. But the hopeful part is at one point you find it and you drift to shore. So that was why the life ring is now kind of on the shore in the second book.
I like that. And then you've got a lighthouse, which I love lighthouses. You know, it's kind of that beacon of hope, you know, that kind of shines through in the darkest night. Tell me more about that book.
So that book is called Grief, Hope, and the Aftermath. And that book is different from the other two in that I used my years of being a facilitator for grief support groups. And I put in that book, each chapter is a different aspect of grief and loss, something that comes up in each support group. So, for example, you might have a night where people are talking about, I don't know what to do with my loved one's belongings. There's a topic. Or someone will say, I don't know what to do about feeling lonely. There's a topic. I don't know what to do about, you know, going out with couples now that I'm single and I've lost my spouse. So each chapter is a different aspect. And then at the end of each chapter, I interviewed somebody from my support groups, any individual from several different support groups, to tell me a little bit about that, to tell me a little bit about their experience with that. And they did. And so I put what they said at the end of each chapter. And I use the lighthouse because, again, you're out in the middle of the ocean, you're looking for help, you're looking for that beacon of light. And so to me, the lighthouse symbolizes that beacon of light when you're lost in your grief.
Yeah, that's great. So you mentioned belongings. And I find that's one of the things that people, I don't know, seem to really argue over, you know, in the aftermath of loss. And I think it was one of the funeral directors that I had on recently that spoke of, they'd stated they usually wait until the casket is in the ground, but that's when the family's, like, gloves come off. I know it's not always that volatile, but tell me about, what would you suggest someone do when they ask, what do I do with my family's belongings? Whether it's something that they see there's no reason to hang on to, but I'm hanging on to it because of the attachment to this person that I lost. What would you tell them?
So I would tell them, you know, I always say with the belongings, I joke about it, and I say you never see a hearse pulling a U-Haul truck, right? So we don't take any of this stuff with us. And I think sometimes we have to keep in mind that a lot of the belongings of these people that we love, that we lose, are important to them. They're not necessarily important to us. So, for example, you know, a husband might be a big football fan. Wife could care less about football. So there's all this football memorabilia, and they hold on to it because they say, well, he loved that. I need to hold on to it. It was his favorite thing. Well, it might have been his favorite thing, but it's not necessarily her favorite thing. So she's holding on to it for that reason. And then I also say the easiest way to go through your loved one's belongings is to look at something and to ask yourself this question: is this bringing me comfort, you know? And so you hear people say, you know, oh, my husband died and his toothbrush is still in the bathroom and I'm going to leave it there forever. And I always say, that's fine. You know, the choice is yours. And so my question to that person would be, so when you look at that toothbrush, does it make you sad or does it make you happy? Does it bring you comfort? And I think if you ask yourself that question, you know, we hold on to these things because we feel like if we let them go, we're letting the person go. And that's not necessarily true because, you know, it really, when it comes down to it, it's all just stuff, you know, and we hold the love we have for the person in our heart. And if, and again, if that's something that brings you comfort, great. You know, there's people, the biggest thing for I mostly work with people that have lost a partner or a spouse, and it's always like the wedding ring, you know, do I leave the wedding ring on? If I take it off, does that mean I'm not married? And honestly, my advice to them is always, if it's bringing you comfort wearing that wedding ring, then wear it. If it's not, then take it off. And, you know, I think it's a process too, because something that's bringing you comfort in the beginning may not bring you comfort several years down the road. So I always tell the story about myself. I kept a pair of sneakers and I thought, you know, out of all these things I could have kept, why am I keeping this pair of sneakers? And it was because in my grief brain, I was thinking, well, if you come back, you need shoes, you know, and so you're going to need a pair of shoes if you come back. And so after some time went by and I processed all this grief, I realized, you know, I came to the acceptance stage of this person's not coming back. So this person's not going to need these shoes. And so then I got rid of them, but I held on to them for a really long time because for that amount of time, they were bringing me a sense of comfort. And then there came a day when I looked at them and I thought, you know, they're really not bringing me comfort anymore. It's not going to make me feel that I'm tossing aside this person or I'm forgetting this person because I'm getting rid of this pair of sneakers. So again, if it brings you comfort, keep it. If it doesn't, toss it.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. The fact that if we get rid of an item, we feel like we're going against or denying that person or the value of that person. And that's simply not the case. One thing that I've always mentioned is, for example, and I need to do this in my own life, I've mentioned this several times. One day I really will do it. I've got this tomahawk that my grandfather painted, and it's like, I do not need this tomahawk in my house. You know, it's great that it meant something to him. It does mean something that, you know, someone gave it to me. My dad gave it to me and said, this was your grandfather's. But what I think I need to do is take a picture of this item, write a story about it, write what it did mean to my grandfather, and then give this thing to Goodwill. It's in a closet. You know, it's, I'm never going to put it out on a mantle. You know, it's just taking up space. And I like the fact that you state, you know, does this bring you comfort? Really? No, it's in a closet. You know, it's, so I think, just being proactive in getting rid of things sometimes, if it's not bringing comfort, as you stated, is a great thing. Gary, tell me more about the bereavement support groups that you facilitate.
So the support groups I facilitate, I work at a wellness center. And the wellness center, the way it's set up is each support group is based on the type of loss. I'm not a huge fan of support groups that are for people that have all different kinds of losses, because I just feel that if, you know, you lost a child and you're in a group with everyone else that lost, you know, a spouse, you're going to have a little bit of a hard time. You know, grief is grief, but there are different types of grief and there's different aspects of that kind of relationship and that kind of loss. So I like the fact that it's broken down. So the groups that I facilitate are for people that lost a partner or spouse. And the way it's set up is you have to be at least 6 weeks out from your loss. We don't like to take anyone in that's fresher than that, because, you know, it's just a little too soon to even, you know, take on an endeavor like that. But the groups are 6 weeks and they meet once a week for an hour and a half. And it's what we call, my groups are set up as a mutual aid group. So I don't run the groups where I go in each night and I say, okay, tonight we're going to talk about this topic. And next week we're going to talk about this topic. I tell my members of my groups that the group belongs to them. And so it's a mutual aid group. They can talk about whatever comes up in whatever, track or aspect of grief they want to talk about. And that's usually the way it runs. You know, someone will just say, I had a bad week. Oh, why is that? Well, my best friend hasn't called me. And then that sparks a conversation. And then it just kind of flows on its own. So it's really helpful. And I always like to point out to people that, again, support groups have pitfalls and positives. And some of, the positives are you have a safe space to sit in a room and you have the ability to talk about your dead person and not feel persecuted for it and feel comfortable doing it and having people that get it. And then, the pitfalls of a group is you're also hearing a lot of sadness. There's a lot of sad stories. And so you have enough of your own sadness on your own plate that you don't need to, be ingesting all this other people's sadness. And so I always tell people, don't take that home with you. You're here and you can all share all these stories, but take your grief home with you. Try not to take the grief home of other people. And then again, there's, some people who just aren't group people, they're not comfortable in a group setting. They're not comfortable sharing. And I always suggest that those people seek either a counselor or a coach to do one-on-one grief counseling, because the problem with losing a loved one is very often it brings up other aspects. People may have underlying either mental health issues, or you may even have issues with your own self that don't come out until that loss. And so if they're personal and they're about you, a group wouldn't be the setting to, talk about something like that. So in that case, that's why I said some people, do well in a group, and some people do well with one-to-one, and some people do well with both.
Yeah. So tell me more about you as a grief coach.
So my grief coaching is, there's a difference between counseling and coaching. So grief counselors are usually licensed professional therapists, and they work with people. They work kind of with the past. They delve into your past. So if you had trauma in your past and now you have this loss and that trauma is resurfacing, they deal with people that have underlying, mental health issues. So they kind of deal with the past, whereas a grief coach like myself, we deal more with the present. Where grief coaches are more for people that, they've done a lot of their grief work, they've processed the grief. Now they're at a point where they're saying, okay, I did all this. I understand, I accept that I had this loss, but I just don't know how to move forward in a healthy way. I just don't know how to find my purpose, how to live a meaningful life. So a coach will work with that person to help them find skills to do that, and help guide them through. And really all we're providing is a safe space for them to talk about this stuff. And it's interesting because as a grief coach, what I find most of my clients tell me is they'll say, I'm so happy talking to you because I'm 4 years out. And I say, that's okay. I'm 4 years out, but I just don't know how to move forward. And I can't talk to my friends and family about it, because when I do, they say to me, oh God, are you still talking about this? Are you still, ruminating over this, And so they're afraid to do that. And so they don't have anyone to bounce these kind of things off of, like, well, where do I go from here? And what do you do? So it's helpful to talk to someone who's been through that experience and also has the resources and the tools to help you work your way forward.
Yeah, I always state that, our friends and family generally will tell us one of two things, either what they think is best for you or what they think you want to hear. And I don't think either of those are beneficial. So I'm definitely an advocate for seeking outside help. You had mentioned a little bit about self-care for even the individuals in bereavement support groups. What do you do for yourself to, working with grieving individuals is quite heavy. And I've really figured that out. Actually, when I first started this podcast, it was like, wow, I was really feeling just heavy each weekend, because I usually record on Thursdays or Fridays. And I just felt really heavy for a while. And it's like, wow, I'm not doing enough self-care. So I started going and getting more massages every 2 weeks. It's like, okay, yeah, this feels much better. I can kind of release all this stuff that I'm taking on. What do you do personally?
So for me, it's interesting you ask, because a lot of people ask me, they say, how can you do the work you do? How can you be around so much sadness and pain all the time. And I was very fortunate in that the mentor I had, you know, she was a clinical social worker who specialized in grief and loss. She's now a professor at a university, and she teaches a thanatology class, which for people that don't know what that is, it's the study of death and dying. And I was very fortunate because she taught me that, you know, she was a great advocate for teaching me that, like I said about the people in the group, don't take everyone's pain into yourself. And so as a grief specialist and coach, I try really hard not to do that. And I think I've done it for long enough that I understand when I'm going to that place. And so I don't go to that place. And I also take time for myself. Again, like I said, I like walking on the beach. I like to read. I make sure that I set aside time that I'm not doing anything that's grief related, because I can't do that 24/7. It would just be, you know, it just wouldn't be healthy for myself. So I try to do that. And I always keep in mind that, you know, my goal is to help these people find hope and help them find their way through grief. I'm not there to take it on myself. That's not my mission. That's not my goal. I just want to be, as I said before, present for them.
Yeah. Being a writer, I'm certain that that is part of your self-care, was writing some of these books and just getting that out on paper. I always encourage my clients to journal, and I'd say about 5% of them do. I it's something that I really encourage, and maybe I just need some blank journals in my office to say, take this home, and I don't care what you put on the paper, just put something down. How do you encourage people to write their story?
So I do encourage people, and I'm a huge advocate because I'm a writer myself, and I journaled a lot after my loss. I have, I think, like 3 full journals from just the first year alone. I would write every day, and I encourage them, you know, to write a letter each night to their loved one, you know, tell them how their day went, you know, just keep that connection going. But there are people that literally do not like to write, and I understand that, you know. And so sometimes I'll tell people, you know, how about if you just, you know, draw something, like draw a picture of what your grief looks like, you know. And it's interesting when people do that, you know, because some people, maybe they don't like to write, but they like to paint, or they like to, you know. So I'll say, well, draw, you know, if you're a painter, then draw, why don't you paint a picture of what your grief looks like? And, you know, it's just a way to process those feelings and get them out in whatever creative way works for you. And so what I do in my coaching, as well as in my support groups, is I give the people homework. I tell them, I'm giving you homework. And sometimes the homework is like something that'll be like, finish this sentence, you know, and it will say, you know, something like, when I think of my loved one, I always blank, you know. And so if they're not a writer, they can at least just fill in a word. And sometimes just filling in that word and filling in that sentence gets them thinking about whatever that is the sentence is about. And so I find that a helpful tool to use for people that don't like to write.
Yeah, I several years ago, my daughter did these 10-second videos just to kind of, I guess, catalog her life she did this for a few years, actually. And it was really neat to watch that, you know, and she would just put, you know, 10 seconds of whatever she was doing that particular day. And I found that very neat. And I think that's a really good way to, if somebody's not willing to write, not willing to journal their thoughts, take a 10-second clip. In fact, one of the girls that I had on early on the podcast, her name was T. She did TikTok videos, and you could kind of see the progression of her grief, and you could actually see her climbing out of the grief. So I think a video log of some sort is a good method as well. I don't know. So there are other options if people don't want to write.
Right. And I agree. And, you know, I have to tell you one story about somebody I met along the way. There's a woman in the United Kingdom who lost her son. I believe he was about 16, who took his own life. And so she came to me, you know, and said, you know, I'm going through all this. And I said, you know, what are you doing? And so what she did was she created a Facebook page, if people want to follow her, called Stefan. His name was Stefan, her son. And it's called, her name is Emma. and it's called Stefan's Memory Stones. And so what she did was she would always take a walk with Stefan, and they would walk through all these different parks and places. And so she painted stones, and everywhere that they would go, whether it was a fast food restaurant or a park or the movie theater, and she would put one of these stones in memory of Stefan. Well, she created this Facebook page called Stefan's Memory Stones, and she asked people to paint a stone. If they were traveling somewhere or going on a trip, put a stone there, take a picture of it, and she would put it on the Facebook page. She now has thousands of Stefan's memory stones all throughout the world. And I just think it's an amazing thing because, you have to do something to honor this person that you lost. And it can be something huge, like someone like the woman who created Mothers Against Drunk Driving, MAD, created that when her daughter was killed going to a church fair. And so that changed laws for drunk driving and saved lives. And so for every life that was saved because someone didn't drive drunk, it's in memory of her daughter. But you don't have to do something huge like that. You can do something as small as painting a stone. And so every time she sees someone put her, a stone somewhere for her son, she's knowing that her son's not forgotten. And that his memory lives on, and that she's honoring him. And I just think that was one of the greatest things I heard for someone finding a way to process their grief and at the same time honor the person that they love and lost.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and that's a great, great thing that we see making meaning out of death, and I think that's so important. Before we started recording, I spoke of a little bit of my journey of how I got here, and the reason one of the reasons that I have such a calling to be in the grief community is because I did lose a best friend 12 years ago. We, as you can see me here, I like playing music. We wrote six songs together that year, and I really miss that. I miss him, and it just kind of drove me to, certification in grief is the only thing above licensure that I have, and it's really the only place that my heart is. Beyond just, I see people for anxiety, depression, things of that nature, certainly, but I have this love for the grieving community. And I think it is through death where we start making meaning, through our own lives, and it drives us to do something more. So I like hearing this lady's, creating stones or leaving stones for people to remember her son. I'm sure that brings joy every time she gets a picture.
Absolutely.
That is great. What are your thoughts on being forgotten versus being remembered?
Well, I always say no one is forgotten as long as we continue to speak their name and tell our stories. And it's so important for people that lost someone that they love to keep telling their story. And I know that's difficult because so many people say, well, nobody wants to hear it anymore. Nobody wants to hear this sad story I have. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a sad story. It can be a memory of them that someone else may be interested in hearing. And I always say the best gift that someone grieving the loss of someone they love can get is when someone else talks about them, or someone else maybe shares a story with, if a coworker shares a story with you about something funny that happened in work. If you lost your husband and his friend from work meet you someday and says like, hey, I'll never forget this day that, John did this. That is such a gift to a person to have that piece of history and that memory shared with them that they themselves didn't even know about. Or, one of the things I do now when someone loses a loved one, someone that I know well and I have to go to the funeral, I always, give them a sympathy card, but in the sympathy card, I put any pictures that I might have of that person that I know that loved one, that person who lost that person doesn't have. And I always feel like that's such a gift to them because they get this picture and this memory that I have of the person that they never even saw. And so you're giving them a piece of this person that they lost. And so, yeah, the best way to do that is to never stop talking about them.
Yeah, I think it would be a great, great idea to have cards at a funeral or visitation where everybody that goes through the line, because you know some of those lines are long and you're waiting for sometimes an hour or you know whatever, but it would be great if everybody that came through that line wrote down their special memory with the person that we all lost in common there. And I don't know, that would be a just a special gift. You know, it's we may not connect with that special memory, but just knowing that the person we lost had a special moment with so many people. You know, we keep records and there's always like the record books at visitations and things that people sign, but what a better gift it would be to have a memory with that signature.
Yeah, my dad passed away a couple of years ago, and at his funeral we did that. We had a bowl and we had these little cards, and we asked each person that came to write a memory of my father on the cards. And it was just such a great thing, especially for my mom, to be able to, you know, go back and read all these things she didn't know, you know, things that people had experienced with my dad that she didn't know. So yeah, it's a great way to keep the memory alive.
Yeah, and you think about when a person passes, we can no longer go to them for the information, but getting information, it's almost like playing detective after a person dies. Learning these stories, it's like, wow, I didn't know that about, you know, my grandfather or my friend or spouse. And just hearing these stories almost changes, not in a bad way, but changes that person into someone that maybe we didn't know. And I'm certain would bring a lot of smiles to grieving people just hearing those stories.
Absolutely.
So I know working with a lot of grieving individuals, boundaries generally pops up. Like, what are some healthy boundaries that you think in times of grief would be helpful for someone? What do you think?
So boundaries, I think that they're, again, like I said, I think the most important thing to do is to be present for the person. So you don't need to ask a lot of questions and you don't need to give advice. You know, the worst thing that a person grieving wants is advice. And it's amazing how when you're grieving, so many people know what you should do, or they feel that they know what's best for you. And really only you know what's best for you. You know, so I know when I had my loss, like people, well, you should do this or you should do that. And people, you know, you're having enough time trying to figure out what your life is going to look like without people telling you, well, you should move out of your house or you should change your job or you should, you know. So really the worst thing to do and the way to keep those boundaries is not to do that, not to give people advice or to push them into doing something. You know, you hear a lot, you know, the standard thing is like, you know, don't do anything in the first year. And I always say, like, don't do anything until you're absolutely ready. It doesn't matter whether it's a year, 2 years. You know, I have situations where people say, well, everyone told me to move out of my house and I moved out of my house. And then 3 years later, I wish I didn't, you know, because in the beginning, your mind is not there. I am an advocate for telling people, you know, to take your time, because when you're fresh in your grief, you aren't thinking correctly, you know. And I always tell the story of people that say, like, you know, they're grieving and they're like, oh, I'm so mad at my daughter because she wasn't there for me. So I'm changing my will and I'm leaving all my money to the cashier at Walmart because every time I go in there, she's so nice to me, you know. And I said, but the problem with that is 3 years later, you may have healed this thing with your daughter. And then, you know, you're going to wish you didn't make that choice. So I think as far as boundaries go, my advice would be to not give advice.
Yeah. One of the things that I hand out to many clients and anyone that has been to one of my grief seminars, I hand out what's called the SRRS, the Social Rating Readjustment Scale. And I'm sure everyone listening has probably seen a variation of it. And it says death of a spouse is worth 100 points. And it goes down and just lists all these life things that we go through, even down to planning a vacation. And that causes stress. So if you have over 150 points, it's stating, okay, you need to start pumping the brakes. If you're over 300 points, you better pull over to the side of the road. Don't make any new life changes. And that's really why I give that out. It's like, okay, you've been through a very, very important loss in your life here. Don't be making major changes, just that, just like you're speaking of. Don't make rash decisions of changing wills or moving out of your home that you've been in for 35, 40 years. That's a huge change on top of a huge loss. What do you think about triggering memories? Whether it's an item, I always say, as small as the smell of a cup of coffee, a song, a location. How do you deal with triggering memories?
I think triggers are tough when you're grieving, but I do think that they're an important part of the grief work. And, for a lot of people, I hear a lot of people that say, like, I haven't cried. I'm just keeping so busy, and I say busy is great, but don't keep so busy that it's keeping you from grieving, because you do need to go through the grieving process. So sometimes triggers, they, as bad as they feel, they're actually a necessary part of the grieving process. And I think that they actually help you do the grief work, because you see these things, and whether it's a happy memory or a sad memory, at least it's something that's triggering those feelings and emotions that, quite frankly, need to come out anyway. So, I know for myself, there were a lot of triggers, and still, 10 years later, I still have triggers. But the triggers are a little different as time goes on, because your grief softens. And so in the beginning, the triggers can be really painful. And then after time goes by, the triggers can then almost bring you joy. So, for example, if you go to a place, maybe you lost your spouse and you had this special place where you went to your honeymoon, and you go there early on in your grief, and it's going to be really sad, because you're going to be focused on the fact that now I'm here alone, I'm not here with this person. And so it's going to trigger that feeling of, the person's not there. But then maybe several years later, you go back, and every place you see where you did something that was really joyful and happy with that person, and then you smile. So the triggers, even though they are painful, they can become a trigger that now brings you joy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think being present with those, as opposed to pushing them away, is very important. Sometimes in counseling, I'll bring up an experiment from the 80s from a guy named Daniel Wegner, and he called it, I think it was called the White Bear Experiment or something along that lines, where I think it's for 2 or 3 minutes you sit there and think of nothing but the white bear. And it's fairly easy to do. If we put our minds on something, unless we're ADHD like me, we can usually hold to that thing fairly well. But then when we try to think, like the next 2 minutes is thinking about anything except the white bear. And our brains can't do it. What happens is our brain wants to check in and say, "Gary, you're not thinking about the white bear, are you? Just checking in." And by doing so, it then sends you down the path of thinking about the white bear. So I think there is portions of this we need to attend to in grief. And it's like you stated, when the triggering memory comes, let it sit with it, and don't try to push it away, because it usually will keep poking at you until you do pay attention to it.
Exactly.
I had one other thought, and it's that maybe that is my ADHD kicking in there. What would you tell people? You and I both have found purpose and meaning through loss, and it drives us to do what we do. What would you tell people as far as maybe their loss is fairly recent? Maybe it's, they're a couple of years out of their loss. What would you tell them as far as trying to find their own purpose and meaning through this loss?
I would tell them to seek help. And I say that meaning that, sometimes we do get stuck on that journey of, what is my purpose? What is my what is my meaning in life? And sometimes you need help with that. And so that's why I do what I do as a grief coach. I try to walk along with them. My tagline that most people know me from is, we're all just walking each other home. And I believe that we are doing that. And I tell people all the time, and I stress to the people that are grieving, is you don't have to do this alone. You're looking for that purpose, and you're looking for that meaning, and you can get help to do that. And sometimes when you get stuck there, and you don't know what to do, you need a little guidance in how to do that. And I think we find meaning in doing something that makes us feel good, and it also makes us feel like we're honoring that person that we lost, because I think it's important to, I know I do what I do because of my loss. And so I wouldn't be doing this. I was a financial person for many, many years. I was an assistant vice president of a major financial corporation, so I had a really good job. But it wasn't maybe feeding my soul. So when someone says to me, you know, what do I do? What's my purpose? How do I find a meaningful life forward? I always say to them, find something that feeds your soul. And it doesn't matter how important or big it is. It can be a small thing. You know, it can be, you know, if you like to paint, maybe you become a teacher at that, or you start a painting class for people to come and do that. And I always say a good way to find what that purpose might be is to volunteer doing something that you have always been interested in. And sometimes when we have a loss, a lot of people, particularly for the people I work with who have lost a partner or a spouse, will say, you know, I always wanted to do this thing, but my partner or spouse was not interested in it, so I didn't do it. So I always say, well, look at it as an adventure. You know, go do this thing, and you have the opportunity now, because you can do whatever you want. You know, you can take care of yourself, and that's a part of your self-care, is to do something that you want, something that feeds your soul, and that particular thing will lead you to what your purpose is.
Gary, what do you think your greatest gift through grief has been?
Probably that I am now a much more compassionate and empathetic person than I ever was. I also was the world's greatest worrier. And I always say worrying works, because 98% of what we worry about never happens anyway. And so I now find myself not sweating the small stuff. I find myself in a calmer place than I probably ever was in my life, because in my mind, I always say to myself, this thing that happened, this really horrible, bad thing that happened, has taught me that one, that was one moment, that was one period, one chapter in my life. It doesn't mean it has to be the rest of my story. And so it's a different chapter, and different doesn't necessarily mean bad. Different can be good in its own unique way. And so I think for me, I found that I'm now this more compassionate, empathetic person who worries less. And I think those are all good things. I think those are all gifts. And I've also met an amazing amount of people on this journey, other people who are now much more compassionate and empathetic, who I'm blessed to have in my life, honored to have in my life, honored to have met because of my loss.
You think about how many roads you and I both took to be here today. Like that's an amazing road for both of us that led us here to meet. And I'm thankful for you being on the show, Gary, and sharing your story and how you're helping the grief community. Anything that you think we've missed or anything that you want to kind of close us out with? Any final thoughts?
Again, I think my final thought would be to people, and I'm bringing it up again because it's so important to me, is, you know, when you're going through grief, ask yourself the question, you know, will doing this make me feel better, or will doing this make me feel worse? You know, and I think that's a good way to help yourself move forward. It's a good way to decide what you should be doing and how you should be living your life, is to ask yourself that question, you know, will doing this make me feel better, or will doing this make me feel worse? And also, I can't stress enough to seek help if you need it, you know, because it's tough. You know, grief is tough. It's messy. It's crazy. And so sometimes you need help, and you don't have to do that alone. There's help out there. There's help out there from people like myself and yourself. And so my biggest piece of advice for people is always seek help.
Excellent. Well, Gary, thank you so much for joining us here. And listeners, thank you for joining in on the Grief Observe podcast. Again, I'll have Gary's information in the show description, his Facebook page, links to his books on Amazon, his website. Feel free to reach out to him and support him in what he does here in the grief community. And again, thanks for being with us, and we will catch you on the next episode. Have a great day, everyone.